There's a bunch of people that are experiencers who've had their DNA taken by, and we can just name them, Gary Nolan, Kit Green, that whole crew. Somebody told them to reach out to Gary Nolan. Gary Nolan reached out to him, said he wasn't crazy, said, you know, this thing happens, this follows bloodlines. Can I have your DNA? And he was like, yeah, okay, cool. He's like, it'll help us get to the bottom of, you know, what we're figuring out. And to this day, he still doesn't know what happened to his DNA or what they did with it.
Contact and Control traces the hidden architecture behind UFO encounters, drawing on Majorowski's own lifelong experiences, his information security background, his deep familiarity with initiatory traditions, and hundreds of hours of interviews with researchers, whistleblowers, and fellow experiencers. The book connects dots that have never been publicly connected before. So very happy to have you on, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about the inspiration and how you ended up actually writing this book.
Oh, dude, thank you very much, man. And like I said, I'm glad that we're friends and, you know, we've been doing this for years. And you're right. I mean, that was the impetus. You know, a lot of it was when I came out and I started doing the podcast, it was basically for, you know, I'd been doing research for years in the background anyway, right? Just trying to connect all the dots. And you're right. It was basically a lot of blog posts, you know, disparate, you know, pieces of information that I put together. And eventually it, you know, after you fill up so many notebooks and like you said, and you do get to the point where, you start drawing some conclusions. And then after all, you know, the podcast, I met some amazing people, obviously we've got connected and everybody else. Right. And then you get into that and through the, you know, physical digging research, you know, looking for documents and things like that. And then meeting the people that are behind a lot of that, those documents and that research, and then getting to know them. And then, you know, just having the reach of the podcast and then, you know, meeting other people and then through Masonry, right? Freemasonry as well, you know, meeting some of the brothers that, you know, we can connect to and getting that deep kind of insider background information, not only from the esoteric side, but from, you know, I would say the, you know, control mechanism, right? So the is kind of what I've been calling it, or whatever that is used to control, you know, what happens to experiencers or the experience itself. And putting that all together, it finally, you know, I was like, this has to come out. Like I have to just, it's been in my head for so long and it's been in my notes, my research in the podcast. And I'm like, I just got to put it all together. So that's what I did. You know, I had been loosely writing it now. It's been like 5 years. So I've been kind of collating it all together. And finally I was just like, I buckled down, you know, winters really suck in Ohio. So I'm like, we're just going to do this winter. I'm just going to get it done. And finally I did. And I got into something that is hopefully coherent and can follow a track that we can kind of see what's going on behind this whole thing. And that's really what it was. You know, I didn't write the book. I didn't to like, you know, be on the book circuit, make money, you know, be labeled a grifter. None of that. What I really wanted to do was just get my experience, my personal experience.
You'll still be labeled a grifter. It's just inevitable. You just got to accept that as part of the territory, I'm afraid.
I know. But you know what I mean? Like I'm not out there trying to make a you know, money. But I wanted to get it out just into the hands of people to be like, look at it from a different perspective, right? From my perspective, and I'm not saying mine's right, but I think I have a unique perspective just because of my place, you know, in everything that I've got my hands into. So for me, it was just kind of like, man, let's get this out there and see what people think. And then, you know, obviously I really want it to be like a stepping stone to other, you know, meeting other people and other experiencers and kind of putting more together. Because once it's out there, people will feel less afraid. I think they'll feel more empowered to be able to, you know, come forward and, you know, not hide. And that's a big part of the book as well. So yeah, it's crazy. And when you start putting the connections, you know, the connections together, you know, the funny meme with the dude with the red string, at some point it all goes into one or two buckets or three, and then you just have to start digging. And that's what I really did. And I mean, to most people, they, you know, they come at it from one side, either like you said, they really deeply believe and they're completely biased. Right. And then the other side is that you're a complete skeptic and you have like, you know, you just want to debunk everything and, you know, say, this is all crap. This isn't real. None of these experiences happen. It's all explainable as, you know, weather balloons, whatever you want to call it. Right.
Which I kind of see them both as being the exact same type of people, just on different polarities of the same thinking process, like believing everything and believing nothing. They're kind of both the same type of cognition in a way.
Right. No, yeah, I think you're totally it. And like, you know, I came at it from a really different spot because I came at it from both directions. I came at it from the skeptical experience, right? From the from the skeptic side, like there has to be a rational explanation for this, you know? And then I also came from it, like you said, as an experiencer. And it wasn't until I started doing some really deep research that I found there was experiences I've had my whole entire life that I didn't think were associated with this at all that end up really being a correlation between a lot of it, you know? Like I say in the book, I was 4 or 5 when I had my first experience with what we would call like a ghost, right? It's an entity, like a, you know, a shadow figure, a figure that was, you know, 3D when I was a kid. And, you know, that was really, really unsettling. That like rocked me for a number of years. You know, the crazy part about that is my dad like knew who it was right away when I told him who it was, you know, it was like, it was the neighbor, like the neighbor's brown derby hat, brown suit. There's a guy, named, Mr. Brown lived next door and he died a couple of years before this experience. And like, so my dad was like, yeah, that looks like Mr. Brown. And like, he didn't admit that. The crazy part is like, he didn't admit that to me. And like, so we had moved out of that house years later, you know? And I was like, shit. He's like, well, I didn't want you to be scared as a kid.
Right.
Right. Right. So like, you know, like I get that you're trying to protect me, but at the same time, you know, like I should have known. So then, you know, and I had other experiences as well, and I just kept having them. And I didn't really correlate that to like any of the UFO lights in the sky experiences at all, because in my mind it didn't. But then after all the research, man, I mean, obviously all of it's totally connected. It's all based on consciousness and our interaction with it, and what, you know, what we perceive and don't perceive, and how we perceive it, and then what we do with that, and then what society does on top of that, right? Like I said, you know, we've been conditioned since the Robinson panel to say you're crazy, you didn't see it, you know, you need a tinfoil hat. Like all of those things are just directed U.S. intel operations to make you believe you're crazy so that they can study it in secret. And the UFO thing, you know, all of that wraps up into, you know, the non-human entities, you know, whatever, non-human intelligences. It all kind of follows the same thing. Like, oh, you're seeing ghosts, you're crazy. It's the whole thing. But I found a lot of correlations between all of it, man.
So how do you try and explain UFOs in the book? And, you know, what is your overall perception of that? I mean, it's a difficult one. It's an umbrella. It's hard to really pin down a real definition. But where are you trying to take people with that?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it is, if you look at the way we have as a society have tried to rebrand what we explain as experiences, right? Lights in the sky were either angels before we had any type of modern machinery, right? You know, you and I have spoken about this a lot. You know, and then modern machinery started to come up, it was just a little bit more advanced, right? It was balloons. It was like, you know, the balloon flap in the 1800s in America, right? It was just, oh yeah, we're flying this to Chicago. We're going to, you know, stop off and do this. And everything is just one little step ahead of our technological curve, right? Where you got to look at it as it's pulling a massive deception, you know, towards humans, human bias deception, right? I mean, it could come down and say whatever you want, but I think that somehow it either provides a filter or relies on our human filter to present itself in a way that would still make it, you know, and it would keep utter ambiguity for it, you know, so that it would be set in a mindset that would be still explainable in some way, but still have that mystical, magical element to it where you just can't really explain it. You have that perception of it. You have the feelings of it. You have the experiences you have after that are those things, but it's still not in the realm of anything that we can possibly even comprehend or describe, you know? So
high strangeness has always been a good definition for it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. Definitely. It's just one of those things where, and you got to think about it. Is it for their own protection or for ours? Right. Like what is it doing? Is it trying to, you know, mimic things, or is it trying to just, is it so connected to our consciousness that it's pulling out bits and pieces of what we understand or our collective consciousness understands as like available and real entities, in, you know, injecting itself as that, or presenting itself as that, like, you know, basically putting the mask on so that we can comprehend it and do it. But I don't really think that it's a ship from Zeta Reticuli that's coming here with some little gray people in it. It could be. I think there's, and that's where it gets really weird. Like you said, there could be this whole host of things that are happening. It could be physical craft. I mean, obviously, you know, there's, you know, the big talk about is, you know, retrievals. And I go into deep about that, you know, with some pretty good evidence about that, how that's true and, you know, verifiable. But there's other parts of this aspect that don't make any sense that could be non-physical as well, or could be both, which is even more bizarre. How is it physical and non-physical, right? Like, so when you get down these rabbit holes, it's like you can't put a pin in any of it. It's just this circular thing. But what I kept coming back to is that there's definitely a control mechanism behind all of it, whether on their, whether on the phenomenon side or our side. And that's been happening since forever, in my opinion.
Or both, right? Or both.
Agree. Probably both.
There could be a control structure beyond human comprehension, and then a human control structure within our world trying to comprehend it in secret. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's true too.
Trying to communicate with it, interact with it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, do you think that this is a phenomenon in relation to like the UFO phenomenon that is the same as ritual phenomena, the type of interactions people might have in those types of settings? Do you separate these two, or is it kind of intertwined, spiritual and physical?
Yeah, I think it's intertwined. And I found that especially when I'm, you know, like I said, through research and through the esoteric orders and, you know, things that I'm a member of, you know, and I talked to...
We should mention that you are a high ranking member of the Freemasonry Order. And do you want to just talk about what you can in terms of like your background with that? So people have an idea of, you know, because, well, it's an important element of this, and understanding the UFO phenomenon from an esoteric perspective has always been something that I think is extremely important. So, you know, you've kind of gone through those initiatory pathways that allow you to get a different type of insight. So if you want to tell people about that background.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, so I got into it, you know, to figure out some mysteries, you know, and masonry is, you know, making good men better, right? Making yourself better and those things. And that's completely true. And all those things have made me a better human totally for that. But I think what I found as you keep going through it is that there's, like I said, and I talk about a lot in the book as well, there's a thread that goes back pretty much, in masonry, they call it time in memoriam. So before time, recorded time, right? And it goes back to basically there's a few tenets that hold true forever. And a lot of it is basically initiatory experience can put you in an altered state, you know, mentally, you're in an altered state where it allows you to be more open to your perceptions, right, for everything around you, right? I know a lot of people speak about, you know, like if you've done, you know, psychedelic mushrooms or LSD or, you know, whatever like that, that it opens up your perceptions and you're more perceptive to the environment and everything around you that you normally wouldn't. In my mind, the initiatory process of these esoteric bodies, it does the same thing without the types of drugs, right? Because of whatever it is, the frequency, the vibration, the actual, you know, ritual itself, the patterns, the things that are due, symbology that's all involved in it, puts you in an altered awareness type of state. Now I'm not going to say it does for everybody, but you know, for most people you talk to, that's kind of what it does. And in that state, it makes you more open to the awareness of, you know, non-human intelligence, as people would call it, God or the spirit or the great architect of the universe or whatever. Right. So I think even at like a subliminal level, it does something to going through those rituals and going through the experience. And in that, I think that's throughout history. So before the modern area of masonry and, you know, Rosicrucianism, things like that, people would do that to commune with non-human intelligences, right? To ask for help, basically they were oracles. They were, you know, asking for, you know, should we plant now? Should we, you know, do this? It was a lot of those things where you get into an altered state through meditation, through, you know, basically introspective awareness to ask for guidance, right? And that guidance came from, you know, call it whatever you want at the time, right? Like I said, that's the same thing that UFOs do. They mimic whatever the current belief system is at the time, right? So if everybody thought it was Yahweh, it was Yahweh. If everybody thought it was, you know, whatever it was, right? Or whatever they tied it to. But I think that's always been with us and that's always in us. And the two, I knew I had to have connected at some point, right? So after I've gone through, you know, a lot of these different, you know, mystery school initiations, it's like, wow, that's what this does. It makes you more open to it. Brother of mine, Jamie Paul Lamb, huge into astrology, you know, now UFO guy, not into, you know, non-human intelligences at all. I had him on the podcast a couple of times and I was, you know, he's written a bunch of books and I've talked to him a lot. And it wasn't until at one point that I told him, I'm like, you know, it's more about the non-human intelligence consciousness part of it where it clicked for him. And he was like, oh my God, that's really what I'm doing as well. Like, you know, the elements, the astronomy, you know, like Mars, for example, or Venus, it has a different type of non-human intelligence that is, you know, that you can invoke and type of do, you know, these things where people read into the future or, you know, things like that. And he's like, holy shit, it's the same thing. So there's all these little interconnected parts of it that I found and I kind of started putting together. And that's what made me write the book. I was like, wow, none of this has really been kind of correlated together to show you where this thread runs from the beginning of time to kind of just to right now, just modern day ufology, which, as you know, is kind of a shit show.
But that's fine. You know, that's fine, because we will have to, you know, try and contribute to change that, which is what you're doing. And one of the things that the book argues is that the phenomenon isn't like the UFO phenomenon. It's not random. So it targets specific genetic profiles. It tracks bloodlines across generations, and it operates with a clear, if opaque, intention. So how are you explaining that exactly in the book?
So that kind of got me into where I didn't really want to believe that, right? And I didn't think that that was a thing. Like, how is that even possible? But it wasn't until the whole fiasco with Gary Nolan on Twitter. And just to remind everybody, I posted a clip from James Gandolfi's podcast of a guy named Andrew Rezowitz talking about how he's an experiencer, right? He's the psychic firefighter. He had experiences that he couldn't explain. I mean, the guy does psychic readings. He's really, really awesome, but he has the ability to do summoning, right? He can go outside, or he just knows when it is. He goes outside and orbs just show up. They'll just come out all the time, you know. It's through love and in you know, interaction, things like that. And he basically, his story, which is, you know, like I said, I put in the book as well, is that he was kind of freaking out when it first started happening to him. He didn't know what was going on. Somebody told him to reach out to Gary Nolan. Gary Nolan reached out to him, said he wasn't crazy, said, you know, this thing happens, this follows bloodlines. Can I have your DNA? And he was like, yeah, okay, cool. He's like, it'll help us get to the bottom of, you know, what we're figuring out. And to this day, he still doesn't know what happened to his DNA or what they did with it or what they did. And so that I posted that clip, and it just was a shitstorm. And I mean, I got attacked from people who I thought were friends. I got attacked from people who I thought were acquaintances, you know, to tell me to take it down. Gary Nolan.
Yeah. Wasn't there like a whole thing about, they wanted to develop like a pharmaceutical product, like something that could actually help people gain this type of ability.
Yeah.
Was that right? Yeah.
Yeah. So then after that, dug into some research, and Andrew connected me to a bunch of people. There's a bunch of people that are experiencers who've had their DNA taken by, and we can just name them, Gary Nolan, Kit Green, that whole crew. And
yeah, the whole kind of Stanford SRI
Bigelow
background.
Yep, that whole time at some point, and they don't know what they did with it. They don't know what it turned into. Furthering the research, you know,
that's a bit creepy.
Yeah, furthering the research, you know, Nolan said in Diana Pasulka's book, is her first book, that, you know, when he was still anonymous, he said that he wanted to create a drug that could turn on or off the psychic ability. So I think his impetus, he said in the book, was basically like, if people were just too overrun by this, for some people, this is too much to have this type of ability to, you know, like, I don't want to talk to these things, they're coming down, you know, like I didn't sign up for this. You just, you know, he wanted to give the ability to turn it off. Right. So like, hey, I don't have to do this. But on the flip side, it's an amazingly, it's probably $1 trillion drug for the IC. You'd imagine super soldiers who were psychic, who didn't need to speak, they were telepathic. He would take this drug intranasally, and then you would just be able to communicate. You'd be able to see things in a way that your perceptions were enhanced and all these other things that are happening. You could just basically be a super soldier, right? So that's why I think the secrecy and the big, you know, shutdown of it, where everybody's talking about it. They don't want anybody talking about it. They want to be able to probably manufacture this and sell it. And as I found, that's pretty much the case. Dr. Dean Radin has got a separate company who's basically came out and said they were able to do this. They've narrowed down the actual receptors, what they need to turn on and off. They can do it intranasally through a nose spray. And depending on how they tweak it, it can be just for a temporary or forever. And he said it, he came out and he said, I'm kind of nervous that once this gets out, I'm nervous that something will happen to me in the research. So I just want to say this, that this is where it's going. If something happens to me, this is where we're at, and this is where it went. So you think about that in context, it's like, it's happened. It's already happened. It's not in the stages of just, you know, clinical trials now. That's already down the road. So what are we dealing with? Right. And it's all on the backs of people like you and I, who are experiencers, right? Who they've been able to take our DNA, our blood, or whatever, and figure out the processes that make us different, or you know, whatever synapses need to fire differently to be able to turn this phenomenon on. for people who don't.
Oh man, well, I mean, I reached out to Gary Nolan back when I was like a fan. I was still interviewing these guys and actively interested in everything. And, you know, I emailed him a few times describing my experiences, what I thought caused them. But he never got in touch with me. So they never took my genetics. I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I guess like I probably dodged a bullet on that one. But yeah, I was hoping that they would take some form of an interest, but they never did. And I like you, have had a pretty interesting journey of realization through the last few years. But I'd like to get your position on what you're thinking about the modern disclosure movement from around 2017 to present day. You know, this is something that we all got very excited over, and I would like to know your evolution of thought on this.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think that's kind of what connected all of us together, right? I mean, once...
It really was, yeah.
Yeah, TTSA came out, you know, everybody was like, this is it, right? Everybody did feel at that moment that DeLong and everybody on that crew were going to be the ones to usher in modern day disclosure, right? They're going to get people upstage, you're doing this. Tom talked about it for years before it happened. He came out and did it. He started doing the things he said he was going to do. And then, you know, everybody was still really skeptical until the WikiLeaks happened, you know, until the WikiLeaks, Podesta's emails got hacked because, you know, the Hillary Clinton, leak. And then all of the things he had been saying, you know, on Rogan, on all these other podcasts came out to be true, that he was having these conversations with these people. And he
talking to John Podesta, talking to, the now missing McCasland, General McCasland, who's still missing, bro. What the fuck? Like, this is a high profile dude. Not to jump onto a whole other subject, but for real, like, real quick.
No, I think we need to address it.
I know that there's a lot of people pushing back on the idea that you shouldn't be like bandwagoning the UFO subject onto like a situation that is clearly, you know, it's a disturbing situation. I feel for the family, of course. All of that is obvious, but I take exception to the idea that we can't discuss the possibility that a guy that had extremely high classifications that was literally in communication with Tom DeLong, and Tom DeLong wasn't publicly stating this, but was bragging in the back channels to John Podesta, no less, that this was one of his main sources for the UFO conversation in government. And the fact that this guy just vanishes off the face of the earth, and it does seem to kind of roll in tandem with Trump making announcements about the UFO files and how he wants to look into it. And I don't blame people for making this connection. I mean, what do you think?
No, I think it's disturbing. And I think this is what unfortunately, I guess I could always make an addendum to the book, but you know, the book printed right after all this. I mean, I could probably change it.
It's always the way, especially yeah. In this subject, like, you know what I mean? Like next week, suddenly something happens.
Yeah.
Like,
next. Yeah. But I mean, I go through it a lot in the book about the whole connection in DeLong and everything and how that all tied in and, you know, basically how that came out. That's really disturbing. A part of me is kind of, so when I came out, you know, when we met, right, 2017, 18, whatever it was, right? I can't remember what it was. But, you know, I was under the impression, especially with that DeLong initiative, is that they're not going to silence whistleblowers anymore. They're not going to, you know, or researchers, they're not going to show up and, you know, tell you to shut up or threaten you or your family anymore because they're like over it. They're going to do disclosure 2.0. We're going to do it through the media. We're going to do it through young people. We're going to do this. We're going to do podcasts. We're going to, you know, we're going to leak these videos. We're going to do the, and I'm like, okay, cool. Nobody's going to show up and throw you in a van and hog out. So I feel a little bit better, but this whole turn of events, and it's not just him. It's another woman that he had worked with closely. She had disappeared last year as well. There's a whole list of people now that are in and right around that whole organization. Around, you know, basically reverse engineering, in my mind, you know, advanced physics, all these other things that are just disappearing or they're showing up dead. And in my mind,
like the MIT and the Caltech guys that were both shot on their doorsteps, basically, within the space of about 6 months, like 3 months, I think, within the space of about 3 or 4 months, you had those two scientists getting shot. Then you had McCasland going missing. The woman, I can't remember her name.
Yeah, hiking 30 feet behind people and disappeared, like, right, same deal. You know, other people, there was another lady that same kind of MO was where she left her phone, her, you know, keys or whatever, and just disappeared too. And to me, that's really bothersome. And I hope, my hope is that it's some type of control mechanism that we have internally as a government to be like, hey, you're under, you know, these people are either targeted by another foreign adversary, or maybe even the others that, you know, we call the others, or some, you know, something else, is targeting them and they're being taken for protection. That would be the best case scenario in my mind, that there, you know, there's a protocol where, hey, if this goes down, we meet here, there's an extraction point, we take you to some secret underground base or something, you know, to protect you. The other side of that, if you want to look at negatively, is that there is some type of foreign intelligence that knows about these people, who knows what they are and knows what they have, and they've been abducted that way. And then the other wild card, if you want to get all the way into the woo, is that they had advanced knowledge to things that we, you and I, are just scratching at the surface of. They probably have technology and knowledge to do things that we don't even know. Could they meet at a location and teleport, travel, go somewhere? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Could they do any of these things, you know? Like,
oh, what was with that DARPA guy recently, right? That claimed that he teleported into a...
30 miles away in his car? Yeah, you just... Yeah, so it's like...
I didn't dig into that because I'll be honest. I kind of like was just like, what the fuck ever. But like he actually was a DARPA guy.
Yeah, I think he was like the head of energy or something for the government, or close to it.
What?
Yeah, he said he teleported and it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Had a teleport incident, two of them. And I end up at a Waffle House like 50 miles away from where I was. Incredibly frightening moment to experience yourself in your car. Flying through the air. But I tell you, teleporting is no fun.
So he went on some podcast.
Yeah,
saying,
I remember.
Yeah, it was just... So it's like,
what do you think about things like that, though, when someone like that comes out saying something like
this? I don't know. You know, and a lot of it, I mean, you follow disinformation and you follow the tactics and techniques and stuff. Mm. It's like, are they just seeding shit? Are they doing that just to, you know what I mean? Just to point you off the track. But with the McCaslin thing and that crew, I mean, the people that are dead, mm. I mean, that's a horrible thing, right? So then do you do that correlation to that, that you would... we hope those people are not dead, but I mean, that's the thing that's bothersome. It's like, are they reverting back to the tactics they did up until the late 90s, early 2000s, where they would silence people? Like, in silence, I mean, they disappeared, you know, or died. And that's bothersome, you know?
Well, this is, I think that, you know, like, I think there's a whole, like, there really does feel, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, like, there feels like there's a whole kind of, like, circus spiel about who's at risk and who's not at risk. Like, you know, you've got Lou Elizondo sitting Jeremy Corbell down in that little restaurant and going, I think you might be at risk with the things that you're part. It's like, yeah, okay, I don't really believe Jeremy Corbell's at risk. Someone like General McCasland, on the other hand, like, there are levels, right? There are levels. And like, he's a risk. Just in terms of a national security risk, regardless of UFOs, if a Chinese or Russian spy got him, like, he knows things, right? Regardless of what he might know in the legacy UFO program, adding that onto it means that he's even more of a potential risk. So, you know, like, it's used a lot in ufology. Like, you know, you'll even have podcasters who are like, oh, you know, I've been threatened. I'm like, I'm always a bit doubtful of that, only because I've trodden a lot of the same paths and I haven't been threatened. You know what I mean? Like, that's, I'm not speaking with lack of experience. I've met these people, I've gone out and met spooks and done the internet. I haven't ever been actively threatened. So maybe I'm not pushing the right buttons. I don't know. Pretty sure I've pissed off most of the Lou crew. Like, I'm pretty sure I've done everything I can. So yeah, that's why I'm a little bit doubtful of like that level of like the threat circus that I would kind of see it as. But when it comes to someone like McCasland, I think that's a different kettle of fish.
No, I think you're right. And I think everybody else that's probably in those types of positions right now are probably paying very close attention and nervous as well, right? Because maybe that's part of the show as well. Like, hey, look, we did this. If you're thinking about talking, you might go hiking and not come back too, right? Like, you know, that could be part of the sell. I mean, and that's, like I said, that's what that kind of got me twisted a little bit. I mean, there's no way, if you look at it statistically, that all of those people statistically can, you know, for that to be happen, especially intertied to the same type of programs and the same type of military IC, you know, even the private sector field where they're working
within such a short time period
working closely together like that. So I don't know. It's about, like I said, that's one of the things that's kind of really bothersome. But then again, it could be part of the whole circus, you know, it could be just all of the, you know, they might know exactly where he's at and they're just putting this out there to use it in some way, you know, which I've seen time and time again through the research, right?
Yeah. It's a problem that I think is
is one of the hardest actually to kind of like face from the outside, right? But, you know, looking into the classified world and like seeing these figures and these people pop up on emails like John Podesta's WikiLeaks, and you see McCaslin, you start connecting these dots, and there is definitely some signal there. Like, this is a person that was clearly being conversated about in the UFO circle within government, right? Within the intel community that was interested in this. So it's not irrational to place some level of potential on this being related to these types of things. It's very sensitive topics that we're, you know, talking about. So I wonder if there was some element of me, because this is another thing that I'm sure you'll agree with, that I don't think a lot of this is government. I think it's private sector, and I think that there's absolutely some wet works going on in the private sector. I don't think that this is a primarily even black budget government ran program type of situation anymore.
I think you're right. I think, you know, a couple of whistleblowers have already come out and said that there are these corporations and these people that, and right. But we got to remember too that the people that are in these corporations just came right out of military, so they're literally taking off their military hat and they're turning on, and they're, you know, and now I'm working for XYZ corporation over here, right? But I still have all my connections to all my friends that are still in the military. I know I have all these contracts. I can go in there and tell them I'm selling them these services, and it's just one hand for the other. And of course, mm-hmm. there's got to be some kind of quid pro quo, and there's, you know, you know, for these intel.
Well, it's like Pfizer going to work for the CDC, and vice versa. You know, it's this kind of incestuous type of I won't tell on you because we're both working for each other type of situation.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And then like, when you think about it, I mean, if something does happen, the government says they can just be not attributed to it. Like, we didn't tell them to go do that. They just did that. Like, you know, if it comes out there, just the government's going to blame them for whatever and say, it's not under our authorization, right? That's how that whole thing works. It's just, they're doing whatever, right? But they still probably have the technology, they have the resources, they have the, you know, the information, the training to do those type of horrible things. And what would make them stop from doing it, right? Who's going to stop them? Either because they're kind of like the authorities kind of are looking the other way, you know. You would think they would have to be at some point if they're working together, right? Where mm-hmm. they're making that happen, which is even scarier. And that's when it goes back into the whole,
right.
You know, is the technology under control of the corporations? Are these psychic abilities? Are these other things that we're talking about, DNA harvesting and manipulation for consciousness? Are those completely under the control of these corporations? I'm gonna guess yes. It has to be, you know.
Well, that, you know, that begs the question, and one that I would be interested to get your perspective on. Can a meaningful disclosure on this subject be done through government channels in the way that we're kind of being presented as the meaningful way to do it?
You know, I think it's been a cyclical thing. I mean, if you look back to the 40s, I mean, it was, you know, if we go back to that point, it was just basically contain, right? It's control, right? You had, and tie in the title of the book, it's contact and control. You have a contact with something that's otherworldly, and the control mechanism that comes down on that is quick and fast, right? And so that's happened since the beginning of time, and right, and basically the beginning of, you know, modern era that we can, you know, attest to. So I think they've tried all the same type of tactics. It's worked for so long, right? It's worked all the way up until like the 90s or 2000s, but I think there's been different times where people tried to get the information out in a new fashion. You know, there was that whole, you know, when Roswell was leaked and all that stuff, and you know, Moore was given all that information, and he came out and said, hey, look, the CIA gave me all this stuff, and basically burned himself. But he was like, I'm telling you guys, they told me to do this, but they also gave him bullshit too, which is this tactic, right? Mm-hmm. Give you a bunch of stuff and some bullshit so we can burn you, right, when we don't need you anymore. And I think DeLong at some point was like, hey, I've seen this pattern, let me do it a different way that makes you guys look good. That's going to make you guys look like, oh, we're just doing this for the betterment of humanity. Like, we're going to be, you know, we're going to make you guys look good. And at the same time, we're still going to kind of get what you want out of it, where you guys are going to have more control over all of it. Right. So we're going to narrow the scope down to this box where it's these UFOs in the sky and, you know, whatever it is that they're trying to just narrowly get everybody to focus on, and forget about all this other shit. Forget about ESP, forget about non-human intelligence, forget about being able to contact them, you know, and wherever else they don't want you to look, and narrowly focus down into this one thing that they can say, okay, yeah, finally it's it, and begrudgingly, you know, come out and admit to these, you know, few things, right? And you have the arrow, and you have all this other shit that happened, right? Like, oh, we're doing the same thing, you know, we're bringing it out, and people are excited about it, and we shut up about it because we're actually kicking the ball down the road. But I think there's probably some inner interagency conflicting battles, because I've heard from both sides where the people are like, this shit's never coming out. And other people are going, I'm tired of lying about this shit forever. And I got handed a bag of shit and I don't want to keep carrying it, you know?
Well, what fascinates me as well is that you have this kind of like, you know, relatively dry bureaucratic approach. You've got Arrow, you've got the Senate Intelligence Committee, you've got, you know, Christopher Mellon, former deputy assistant SecDef. It's all very kind of, you know, government and officially stamped. But underneath that, and you're right, of course, because this is something that we all discussed early on, is that they were really trying to like not talk about experiences, not talk about consciousness, not talk about contact. And it was very much national security, you know, sovereign airspace, incursions over sensitive airspace, shadowing our carrier flight groups. Holy shit. Oh, my God. What is this kind of stuff? Right. But underneath that, you look at secret machines and it's like, oh, this is quite esoteric. And then you look at To the Stars Academy and you kind of see, like, you know, you read their descriptions and it's about collective consciousness and human awakening. You're like, oh, okay, it's been pretty esoteric. And then you hear Tom DeLonge on Fade to Black saying it's about building weapons to defeat the Archons. And you're like, ah, okay, so this is interesting. You've got this surface level bureaucratic cut and dry type of thing of dealing with this phenomena we just can't explain in Navy pilots, but underneath it, run by the same people, is a essentially Gnostic Christian type of theology that seems to be poking its head up.
Yeah, and that's the part that people don't really dig into, right? Nobody wants to.
That's the part that people never dig into properly.
No, and it's not, and that's.
Not publicly, at least, not publicly, at least.
No, not at all, and I dig deep into it as well. In the book, I mean, I go through the beginning of time, starting pretty much with the Templars and the Neo-Templars. Before them, even, there was a group of people that who became the Templars, you know, that kind of had that understanding, that knowledge that was hidden and kept control of, right? And that's continued to this day, to the part where you have the esoteric knowledge and you have the mystery schools and you have the, you know, the networks of people that are connected to the people that basically run the world, the people that are, you know, the global bankers, the people that, you know, they're in the families that we all know that have had money since the beginning of time, right? And how that gets shuffled through society all the way down to like what we're talking about now, right? It's got this huge structure where they're sitting at the top and it doesn't matter who's running the government or what that government is or country is, they're still pulling the strings. And a lot of these people believe that they are the lineage,
descendants.
Yeah, the lineage of these non-human intelligences, that they honestly believe that they have DNA, that they are part of these bloodlines that are, you know, basically above us, you know, you know, common folk, right? That they're above us because they're endued with these special abilities, right? Psychic or, you know, money or whatever, you know, however they treat it, and that they're still beholden to these entities that some of us would say are just insane, right? Like, what are they doing? Are they really doing these like sacrifices? Are they really doing these type of rituals? Even if they're doing rituals to these gods and goddesses or whatever these entities are, because they believe it works, you know? So they're still doing this since the beginning of time. And that trickles down, but a lot of people won't get into that because they think it's crazy too. And I'm not talking about all the, you know, the shit that we hear about, like the Epstein and all the crazy stuff. I'm just talking about, even if it's just them doing like a solstice thing where they get the family together and they're, you know, they're doing some type of ritual and they're trying to do that. I mean, like, that still happens to these trillionaires and billionaires, and they operate differently, and they operate differently on the belief that they're endued with these special abilities and powers that we don't have.
Yeah. And I think that they utilize mechanisms of social influence to seed these ideas into wider society so they're accepted. And I think that the UFO subject is one of those mechanisms, especially because it bleeds very nicely into esoteric, into Akashic records and downloads and entities. This is all umbrellaed underneath the UFO subject. It's not as simple as saying it's a nuts and bolts spaceship flying saucer phenomenon. This is a very, I mean, my only experiences are with ethereal orbs of light. I mean, what are we to say about that? You know, is this an alien probe, or is it a spirit, or something that I can't even begin to comprehend? So the UFO subject is actually like the perfect breeding ground for this type of op, because it's already kind of allowing for a lot of fantasy. You're already allowing, you know, so many different potential possibilities to be entertained as testimony, a story. You have to decide which ones you believe. We know there's a lot of liars, we know there's a lot of grifters, and we know that there's a lot of intelligence ops that do the same thing, distributing information into this space to get it to kind of percolate and either go down a particular direction or misdirect us away from a particular direction. But I think it's very similar, and I've said this a couple of times, for anyone who's fans of the books or the films, Dune, it's very similar to like the Bene Gesserit, which actually has an analog in real life with like the Jesuits, right? But it's like the Bene Gesserit, you know, people that would like over generations seed prophecy and seed ideas that would then come to fruition in a way that seems spiritually ordained, but was actually just engineered from the highest strata of society. And I think that we are dealing with that very much in the elite circles. I mean, look at who was bankrolling and jumpstarting so much of the UFO conversation back in the day. Was it Lawrence Rockefeller? Right.
Yeah.
Was it Lawrence Rockefeller, or was it one of the Rockefellers?
You're right, Lawrence. But then you look at it from, you know, my friend John Warren IV, who did the, you know,
he
did the foreword too. And you know, his family, you know, the Mellons funded Carl Jung, and you know, they actually have one of the largest private collections of esoteric texts on the planet.
The Mellons do, or John?
Yeah, the Mellons. So like it would be his grandfather and his grandmother. They went all over the world and collected these texts that you still can't get your hands on, right? A lot of them are just the, you know, maybe one-off esoteric texts that are from all over the globe. And I mean, I don't know how much money they spent, but
was it Paul Mellon that like kind of bankrolled Carl Jung?
Yeah. Yep. So then you're looking at that, you're looking at psychology, you're looking at, you know, the esoteric, and you're looking at all, you know, where are they spending their time and their money?
And UFOs as well. I mean, he was really, Carl Jung wrote a book or two about UFOs, you know, it all intersects and connects together.
Right. But I think they do a really good job of keeping it separate. Right. I think they really do. And, you know, it wasn't until that I really started digging into it. And you and I, when we were at Contact in the Desert a couple of years ago, when we ran into, oh my God, my brain is freezing. But Doc, Dr. Jeff. Jeff. He's gonna kill me.
Oh, well, the guy that we were talking to for ages.
Yeah, it's
Owl on the fire pit section.
And this is probably
I forgot his name. Man, I'm sorry,
no, me
Doc.
Too. It's you know what sucks with that is because you get old and you get to probably
your brain just starts dripping out your ears.
Yeah.
He was a good guy.
Jeff Long, that's it. Long.
Jeff Long.
That's it. So we're just randomly sitting by the fireplace and we just start talking to him, and he's just like the coolest dude ever. And, you know, he's done 40 years experiences of people with near death experiences, and he's got a survey, and like, you know, he stumbled upon that through synchronicities, and he's an oncologist doctor. He's like, he deals with cancer patients, children, you know, like pretty much. So he didn't want anything to do with this, and he kept himself secret forever. But dude, he's got like, you know, bestseller New York Times books. He's on Oprah, you know, like everything. And he's basically done the research to show that there's a consistent pattern of people that have come back from being dead, near-death experiences that basically transcend everything we know, that no matter what religion you are, no matter what background you have, you know, everybody has the same type of experience. You see a white light, you meet people that you've met, you know, your family, your friends, it's the most amazing experience you've ever had, and you're happy, and you come back. And a lot of the times when you come back, you don't want to come back, but all of the things that you were told pretty much that you're going to have kids, these, how many kids you're going to have, these, you know, all these things that end up becoming true. And a lot of that correlation as well as these people also become more psychic. They have more experiences with UFOs. They have more experiences with orbs of light. They have precognitive events and things like that in their lives. And it's like, well, where's that all meet? And I think it was really exciting for me when I was researching the book, is after meeting Dr. Long, you know, we did podcast talk and everything's great guy. He ended up being a runner up for Robert Bigelow's Consciousness. Dr. Jeffrey Mislav, I know you've done an interview with him. He won that. Yeah. You know, Bigelow put out like $1 million to be able to write papers to, you know, prove without a doubt that life after death exists, right? So Dr. Jeffrey Mislav won that contest, and then Dr. Jeffrey Long was one of the runner-ups. And, you know, Bigelow put out these series of books, and I actually got them. There's like 5 series of books. He sent them to every university all over the place of all these research papers that everybody submitted to him. Bigelow at one point was so gung-ho into ufology, you know, run NIDS, everything. We know, we talk about Kelleher and everybody run all this stuff out. But at one point, he just switched and he went right to life after death, consciousness, and spent all of his money. And I think he's still in that realm now, right? So where's that flip, right? Nick Cook, I know you're speaking to Nick Cook a few times. Nick Cook has done the same thing. He's went from the nuts and bolts. He was the guy writing for Jane's Defense,
the Hunt for Zero Point and Black Budget Tech, and now he's done a complete flip.
And he's working for Bigelow, and now he's doing all of his research on consciousness studies and life after death, right?
I think that was primarily based on the experience his wife had. You know that experience? Her mother, I think it was the mother, and she had a she for those who don't know, Nick Cook's wife was present when her mother was dying in hospital, and they were all present. And apparently, when Nick's wife's mom died, Nick's wife turned around and said, "It's all fine. It's all absolutely fine." And Nick was like, "Whoa, what are you talking about? You know, your mum's just died." And apparently she had a shared death experience with her mum and actually, you know, had a full-blown visual experience with her mum of seeing her pass over to the other side and you know, safe in the afterlife, and was content. And I mean, that was one of the first times I've ever heard of that. I looked it up. It's something that people have experienced, but it's not that common. And I just thought it was an incredible experience. And obviously, like, you know, he's going to believe his wife. And for a very kind of material reductionist kind of grounded thinker, I think it was a huge catalyst for him. And yeah, he ended up being involved in Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies and has, you know, done that flip. And this is something we've talked about a lot, that the deeper you go, it's almost inevitable with the UFO subject. You are going to end up in a spiritual domain and a strange realm of astral and ethereal, and you're going to be scratching your head going, hang on a second, like, this isn't just a physical situation whatsoever.
Right. And I think in my book, I do a really good job of basically starting everybody out at that point. And getting that, and right. Kind of at the end, I kind of get everybody to the, okay, these things happen, these are provable. You know, this is what we got to. And then at the end, it does tie into consciousness and then the studies and the things that are happening on that level. And the thing that took me the longest on the book, believe it or not, is that there's like 430 endnotes, right? So when I'm writing this book and you read some of it, you're like, this shit can't be real. Like, there's no way, like, this Majorowski's off his rocker. Like, this isn't even real. But then, you know, I sourced everything that I put in the book, right? So, like, you can flip back to the back of the book and find this, that this is this study, this is this source, right? And that's what really took me the longest, because I didn't want people to come off thinking that way, you're just babbling, you know, you're regurgitating things you've heard from other people and whatever. But man, I think it really, for the people that really need to get a hold of that nuts and bolts, and, like, you know, they're not really sold on the other aspect of disclosure or other aspect of, you know, what we're dealing with, I think I do a good job of kind of arcing it from, like, oh, we know these things are real, but then also these things are real, right? This consciousness part is real. The weaponization of consciousness is real, you know, and all of these things, so that you can have a broader scope, because right now I think everything's so narrowed. But like I said, it wasn't easy, but I tried to span it to the point where, you know, you start from what you are. And then one of the biggest things that I really want to talk about, I think that's huge, is that we've been systematically told that we are not, as humans, not powerful, not capable of these things, not capable of extrasensory perception, not capable of, you know, telepathy, not capable of, you know, feeling things, knowing things before they happen and all that. And that's been really suppressed since the beginning of time, to put us down to a part where you're just nothing, you know, like, but, you know, there's a whole chapter called you're more powerful than you know. And it goes, I could just go into the whole entire thing of, you know, this is not anecdotes. These are things that have happened since the beginning of time. There's things you can actively do right now to, you know, experience these things, just a little bit of work. Like, you go meditate in the woods, you meditate, you ask for a sign, you ask for something to happen, you know, you put in the work and you put yourself out there, and man, things happen, right?
You know, for me personally, I think the most shocking revelation and what made me want to go out and start talking publicly and, you know, put a camera up and discuss my experiences was that I'm not a meditative practitioner. I'm not disciplined in this type of thing whatsoever. And that's why I do think, and it's a very difficult situation. Maybe you can talk about this as well. Because I'm not a big fan of faith and belief. I'm not a big fan of that. I'd like to have like some actual grounded understanding in something other than just a leap of faith. But with the contact practices, I do think that there is a level of belief and faith, if not only in just your own abilities, and that in of itself, I think, is an activator of very real biophysical mechanisms within the body. So your perception, your idea of what you're capable of, can then have like subcellular interactions with the elements of your body that can begin quantum processes, that can interact with wider substrates of information. But because we have this blockage in our head, because again, like you said, it's been, you know, socially reinforced our entire lives that these things are just childish. It's a, you know, it's a silly little magical idea, and you get over it and you move on when you, you know, become an adult, and you just don't think about those things anymore. So it's so suppressed in our mind. So you do have to have a level of faith and belief. And I, you know, for me, I was a week prior to having the idea of contact introduced into my head, a week prior to that, I was sitting on my bed, like actually asking the universe, like I need something that I can do that applies to all this research that I've been, you know, kind of collecting over the years about consciousness. I don't care if it's not real, I don't care about it. So I want proof. I want something real. Right. And then like a week later, my friend's like, oh, you got to watch this documentary, Unacknowledged. This is before I was in the UFO subject. Oh, yeah. Like showed me Stephen Greer's documentary. Greer introduces CE5 to me. And if I hadn't been previously on that bed asking for a sign, I probably would have glazed right over it. But because I had been on that bed asking for a sign, you know, Greer introducing this concept of conscious initiated contact was exactly the kind of thing I was asking for. And so in a form of faith, I went out with the belief like that was a message from the universe. I believe in this. And I just think that sometimes if you're not lucky enough to have that kind of, like, trust me when I say lucky, I was not in a great space when I was on my bed asking for signs from the universe. Like, you know what I mean? But if you're not lucky enough to kind of be given that strange synchronistic situation that clicks something in your mind, then you might not be able to do this contact just based solely on the fact that you don't believe it's possible. But I did believe it was possible, and then it worked. And now I'm kind of like, well, I don't want to just believe and I don't want to just preach faith, but there is a kernel of it that seems to be in some way required, right? I mean, how do you feel about it?
No, yeah, totally. I mean, I dig through that entire thing too. It's in the same chapter where it's like you're more powerful than you know. I mean, the placebo effect is you know, you look at documented research on the placebo effect where sometimes it's 80% effective. 80% or more as effective as the placebo is in the actual medication itself, right? And you look at it and you're like...
Which is just sheer belief.
At that point, it's sheer belief, you know? And then you look at the other part of that where I think in the early 90s, middle 90s or something, there was I think it was the Indiana State and this could be completely wrong, but I think it was like Indiana State basketball team. There were a couple other basketball teams. And what they did was they did like a whole season of... like instead of going shooting free throws before the game starts, right? We're going to meditate. We're going to sit in the locker room. We're going to meditate, and you're going to sit there and visualize you shooting the ball, and the ball is going into the hoop. And like the percentage of the team, so they had the control, right? The other team wasn't dare out there shooting free throws. These guys are sitting here just completely thinking about in their heads, eyes closed, a ball going through a hoop. And those guys' percentage was like astronomical compared to the guys that were physically shooting the ball.
It's wild.
And you're like,
isn't
well,
it?
Then what is that? So that it's all belief and like you're exactly right. It's all belief and consciousness. Like you can believe I can do it, right? You don't believe you can do it. It's never going to happen, you know?
It's like I believe it requires a level of belief, but I also believe it can be scientifically evidenced.
Oh, of course.
We're just kind of on the edges of getting there.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and that's a big thing too. I talked about Dr. Bingston. He's a guy who's done he wrote a book called The Energy Cure, but it's not really The Energy Cure. He's a pretty funny guy, but that's a whole different thing too as well, where it's basically having this connection to non-localized healing of pretty much everything. And he's done it in a clinical study, right? Where he's injected mice with cancer. 28 days, these mice completely die no matter what, you know, no big deal. But, you know, he came up with a thing it was called rapid image cycling. And basically you think of all these images of all the cool stuff you ever want, very specific. You want a Porsche, you want a house on a beach, you want a jet, you know, whatever, right? And you just keep cycling these images in your head over and over. And these people would just stand there, you know, and put their hand over the cage and do the cycling thing, keep the other mice completely separate. And, you know, what happens is kind of crazy. These mice get really bad. They look like they're going to die. The tumors get really big and they look really gross and like they're going to die. And then all of a sudden they reverse and these mice are completely cancer free. Right. And the crazier part about that is that it's been duplicated at different places, you know, different universities. The even crazier part is you can take the blood out of that mouse that happened to and inject it into another mouse, and that mouse won't get cancer. Or that mouse will be cured of cancer. So then they went even farther and they were able to figure out how to do that and basically put that healing intention into water and then give somebody that has no idea about what the hell this water is, the water, and then do a study to show that water actually heals the person of whatever their, you know, different ailments are. And then
these are actually like genuine studies.
Yeah, that Bill Bengston's in my book. It's like these are definite things.
Wow.
Here's where it comes into the ufology thing. I didn't know about this until I found out about it.
What if someone puts some malicious energy in your water?
Oh, there's that. Well, they'd be able to do with an audio file. They'd be able to do with an audio file. There's no auditory there, so they basically record all this recording equipment, recorded somebody doing this, played that for the mice. Right. So that's just nothing. It's just white noise. It's just me in there doing whatever. White noise for the mouse. on the other side of the country or whatever, and these mice get healed.
What the fuck?
Right, dude. That's what I'm saying. This is the shit I put in my book, and I'm like, it sounds insane, but it's cited, it's sourced, right? Like, it's literally in here, man. I put it so, like, and here's where it gets crazy. Wow. The UFO thing is that I have a theory. Do you remember when Tom DeLonge's bandmate Mark Hoppus had pancreatic cancer a couple of years ago? He was like, how many people you know came back from pancreatic cancer? Do you know anybody that came?
Well, I don't know anyone who had pancreatic cancer, but it's not a good one to get.
Yeah, and they went touring, right? After that, somebody asked Bengston in an interview if he had anything to do with it, and he said, there's HIPAA laws, and I can't say anything about that.
Okay.
But DeLonge was talking about the mice, and he was just talking about the mice without talking about Bengston at all, and he was talking about this.
Interesting.
So then I followed this whole trail, right, and I found this part. And then I started digging into Hoppus, because I was like, oh, Mark Hoppus, right? Blink-182, bass player, funny dude, whatever. His entire family, this is all in the book too, his entire family, I see, Black World, Deep State.
Yeah, didn't he help with like Bin Laden capturing or something? Like, he did. It's like a fucking story.
He said, you want to figure out how to find them? It's easy. They do the call to prayer or whatever every day. He's like, just fly over, you know, Afghanistan with a different signal that you can only pick up through infrasound, right? So it's like whatever this hertz is, whatever, and then just play back. You know, because they were coming out with Bin Laden was coming out videos going, you know, death to America, you know, all this other bullshit, right? And he's like, as soon as you find the place where you hear the recording of the infrasound, you know where he's at. He's in this region of wherever you're flying the shit over. And then it was like 3 weeks later or something, they found.
But this was like something that he actually was sitting with some people advising them, right?
Yeah,
like,
he told them.
Like,
yeah.
This is two different members of the same band who are deeply enamored into the U.S. intelligence communities. Like, it's weird, man. Like,
his dad is, his name is Tex Hoppus, and his dad, you can't find anything about. His dad worked at the test ranges and all that shit for like 30 years. So his dad was like all the classified deep shit that you can ever imagine. And then his brothers and sisters as well, all had, they're all interconnected into this Black World military. And yes.
Really? Like his whole, so he's the odd one out. Unless he's not the odd one out and he is icy, but he's doing a music career front, like, you know.
I don't know, man. But then DeLonge's family as well. I mean, his brother was in Navy Special Forces, you know, things like that. His, like, that's not something that is lightly taken either. So when you come at it and you're looking at, because everybody just thinks like, okay, these dudes are out there making dick jokes. And then all of a sudden DeLonge's talking about UFOs. Like, dude, this is really like, and I literally dig all into it in the book. I'm like, those two right there, just those two connections as his family will get you into the door, right? We'll get you at least to have a conversation, right? And then give you the credibility and the things like that. And then, you know, one of my theories is, and like I said, I wrote, I think that, you know, DeLonge's a Freemason, and I think that he kind of used that to open doors as well. Like, I don't know if McCasland is. I don't know if a lot of them, but I know that Edgar Mitchell was. I know him and Edgar Mitchell were brothers, and Edgar Mitchell was really, he was in the WikiLeaks as well. He was the one kind of, you know, pushing really hard for disclosure too, and we was in the Podesta email. So I tried to tie a lot of the Masonic connections in there and put those in there as well, because I think that's kind of one of those things that it might have been leveraged, you know, at the time for disclosure, you know, at least the modern movement. But
so you go into like the ancient times, you said you talked about kind of like the Templar origins of this. Is that relating to the UFO subject, or is that more to just kind of like the esoteric orders that then inspired it, or like how are you tying in like the more ancient side of this?
So like I kind of tied into it from the control structure of basically the Roman Catholic Church, right? So yeah, the Roman Catholic Church, you know, and the Templars, everybody knows about the whole, you know, Jacques de Molay being burned at the stake for heresy, right? But then why? And then I get into the why, and then you go back to, you know, it goes back to money, but it also goes back into the esoteric knowledge that they held and that they were keeping from, you know, the Catholic Church in a way that the Catholic Church, I mean, a lot of people don't know, it probably still is, but they were the very first CIA. They were the first intelligence agency, right? They knew everything, and they still do, right? They know everything everywhere all the time. And then they also have the most money on the planet, right? So you have those two things. You have all the intel and you have all the money. You basically are running everything, right? There's other competing control structures as well. But to have that, you basically incorporate whatever type of esoteric knowledge you need or destroy it, right? But it never really got destroyed. And that's what I get into is that, you know, when the Library of Alexandria supposedly burned, it didn't, you know, or part of it did, but all the good stuff got buried in the Vatican archive, right? The Vatican would go around, kill your religion, kill, you know, take all your stuff, but all the good esoteric things, like, pushed into the either the belief structure or pushed into the actual basement, right? Where they have that those things hidden, right? And then how do they use
famous examples being like the Babylon fish god hat that's still worn and various elements that come to ancient theologic practice that's not Christian and not Catholic.
Yeah, totally, man. You nailed it, right? You know, that's completely it. So the control structure there, you know, where the Templars trying to, you know, basically give people the ability to find your connection to whatever this is via consciousness outside of the controlled religion. And I believe that's kind of what it was, right? How do you have that connection to the magical, the mystical, the great architect, whatever you want to call it, right? Without having to be through an intermediary like the church or a priest or whatever, right? So that was a control. But I also think that they did hold relics. They did hold esoteric knowledge that was, you know, that they could speak directly to the divine or what we consider the divine, right? Like in some way. And that was a direct threat, right? So that's continuing to this day. That it's either assimilated or destroyed. And it's never really destroyed. It's just assimilated and captured and controlled and put into, you know, a locked thing where they're studying it. I mean, what I get into with that as well is that they have the Vatican has one of the world's largest binocular telescopes. So there's two telescopes and it's on a mountain in Arizona. And that was named Lucifer. That was the damn acronym
That's
for
crazy,
it.
Crazy, right? It's like no one would believe you if you said that. But when you actually look it up, it's fucking true. Like, it's 100% a true statement that he just said.
It is. And then I cite it. That's what I'm saying. I cited everything. It was like, nobody's going to believe this. But it's like, yeah, no, they
do. When I first heard it, I was like, get out of town. You look it up. It's like, oh, Lucifer. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then they changed the name because it got too much heat. Yeah, they're like, oh, maybe we should change this a little bit. Yeah,
you think?
Yeah. Dude, and it was like they did some shady shit to get to be able to have that. They basically, it was a Native American site. It was really important to them. And the Jesuits came in and were like, you don't have any bones. You don't have anything buried here. We're just taking
it. We're putting our Lucifer scope here. Get the fuck out.
Yeah. That's wild. I actually did a remote viewing. I got, had somebody reach out to me, you know, and I am not a remote viewer. I can kind of hobble my way through it, really, you know, just as, you know, to try it. I don't have any practice in or whatever, but somebody asked me to do it. And I guess there was somebody who was soliciting people to do it, like, you know, people that weren't experienced remote viewers. They wanted somebody like, kind of like, cool, that's me. I'm not like, sign me up, right? And I did it. And then I said, I'll do it, but I want to see what everybody else said, right? About this mountain. It was this mountain, right? We didn't know what it was, but it was this mountain. And it came back that this is what it was. And everybody got all this weird stuff, like, you know, it's protected. That mountain you can't get up on. The local police are not allowed to go up there. A couple times a year, like, all these black cars, all this stuff shows up and nobody's allowed to go up and down in there. You know, it's all locked down. They do farm it out. They let the University of Arizona, I think, use it every once in a while. But, like, I think it still is one of the most powerful ones. And like the Vatican, right? The Vatican Church, they own this. And they've been doing this since the beginning of time, too. They've always had the most advanced technology as far as telescopes, you know, and things like that. But I did this remote viewing, and in it, I found I have no idea what it was, but I was just like a time machine volcano. And I'm like, I have no idea what the fuck that means, right? Yeah, I remote viewed it. And I'm like, because they just gave me the coordinates, right? So then it was just a time machine volcano. And then it showed up with this thing, and I'm like, so I started digging into it. I was like, well, this mountain could be an extinct volcano. And I'm like, okay, but it's not, you know, 100. And I'm thinking, what the fuck does this mean? Like, I don't know, man. So I go into it a little bit, but, like, you know, other people had some other bizarre remote viewing experiences, but that sends you down the whole rabbit hole. Like, the Vatican has all this money. They're hiding all the shit. Well, what are they looking for? They're looking into the heavens. They're looking at the stars. Do they have communications with beings or entities that we don't? Sure. They say they talk to God, right? But what does that mean?
Well, it kind of feels like, you know, the institutional religions have played the role of, like you said, an intermediary, like severing our own connection in replacement of a priestly class that will do the connecting for us and then distill it down into, well, at one point, Latin. Thanks for that, because we, you know, all understood Latin at the time.
It's like a gatekeeping control mechanism.
Exactly, to a mystical language from a mystical class. And you look in awe of these people who can speak this ancient language of God. So again, it's all control structure. It's all kind of like, you know, ways of removing you from the source. And I think that, you know, there's an element of perhaps even the phenomenon, like the phenomenon in regards to like the UFO subject, that is involved in the invoking of religion. And, you know, the fact that, and this is something that I guess I would be in agreement with Tom DeLonge on, is all these various religions around the world have done nothing other than fuel conflict with each other, right? For having differing views, differing opinions, differing visions of differing gods. And I wonder if it is the same phenomena interacting with us in different places, in different kind of like visages, but it's actually, you know, the same presence, and is stoking a type of conflict in humanity. We're not growing because we all have our different severed connection to God through a priestly class that disagree with that other priestly class, and we're all stuck in the middle of that chaos. So I feel like a spiritual connection might have been kind of interfered with.
I completely agree. I think you're right there. I think that that's, and people now are seeing that, and it's maybe not even seeing it, they're feeling it. You know, they're not feeling connected to the old things that they were connected to. They're not seeing the connection. You look at the, you know, all of the scandals and all the shit going on in the Catholic Church and all the other churches and all the other religions, and everybody's just going, why am I, I didn't sign up for this. You know, this isn't what I thought. Right. And I always argue too, that there's gotta be some type of still magic still left there, like a little tiny percentage of it in that mass. It's cause you think about it, if you got Catholic mass, is a ritual. If you've ever been to one, uh-huh. You know, you're doing the same. It's everybody stands up, everybody sits down, everybody says this, you repeat this, you do that. They get up there, they turn the wine into the blood of Christ. You know, they turn the bread into, you know, the symbolic presence of God's, you know, body. Like, so you're doing a magical ritual every time you go into a Catholic church. You know, it's rote and it's in Latin, even, you know, sometimes or whatever, you don't understand it, but you get like a feeling from it. Cause, or if not, you wouldn't show up and hand them money. You know what I mean? So maybe like it's been distilled. Like maybe in the beginning it was amazing. Maybe there was magical shit happening for real, like visual, and, you know, people, there's been documented people getting healed and, you know, all these things and the power of collective consciousness, you know, but I think it's been distilled and like commercialized now to the point where there's like 0.01% of some shit going on that's really cool still, because if not, it wouldn't exist, you know?
I think they all have a kernel of fundamental truth enveloped within them somewhere, but layers of human ego and, you know, complex institutional growth and power struggles, and mainly ego, I think, probably ego being one of the biggest competitors in just terms of like, you know, wanting your belief system to be the one that other people believe in because you believe in it so badly. And so I think that after a while, you just start to corrode away what was at one point a true message, a pure message, a brilliant message. And again, that's why I think that, you know, essentially all organized religion falls into the same, you know, trouble. And that's why I would kind of see myself outside of that. I'm just a spiritual person, you know, I'm not religious in any sort of specific sense.
Yeah, no, I'm not knocking it. I mean, for some people, it's amazing. That's their entire lives. But at the same time, you know, you got to see that, like you said, the correlation is there's always something there that's the same. And it's been gatekeeped and forbidden from us to truly know. And I think as an experiencer, like you and I and other people are experiencers, we have that, until you've really like experienced something unknown, you don't really have the window for your frame of reference, right, or for your own consciousness to like even be able to open up to other things that are like that. And I think once you are, that's what I always joke around, and I've said it forever, I think like the things you saw, the orange orbs, the things I've seen, it's like the gateway drug. It's like it's like you see,
oh totally,
you see those things and you're like, well, holy shit, this is real. And like, this is real, then what else is real? And then other things, you open up your perception, and they're like, well, other things, you start seeing the synchronicities, you start, you know, connecting to other people that have the same experiences and that, and yeah, like the shared experience I had, like the white lady experience I had. I go deep into that, and I go in deep into the history of those with Fatima, Chris Bledsoe, with, you know, that's like the modern day one, with all the other people that have had experiences, and all these people are still kind of finding each other now, even modern day, through random ways that people are like, well, you had experience too? Yeah, and I did. And people that you can talk to that know who've had these experiences because they have the details that you don't necessarily put out there, right? And you're like, holy shit. This really happened. And I've had those conversations with those people, and I put all of it in the book, and it's like, what is it? And I keep going back to, it's like a control, I feel like it's a control mechanism for humanity. But I think that, you know, once you have the contact, the control is just as strong, you know, it's just as strong. And then what is that? And that's what I've been trying to dig out. Like, why is that? And what does it serve, you know, and how do you even get around it? And I think the first way you do that is by recognizing it and understanding that's there, and then look for ways to do, you know, connect with other people, connect with other experiencers, can share your story. We have the internet now. We can talk to people all over the world and build up a better understanding of who we are as humans, you know, and what we do here. That's the best thing we can do so far. I don't have the key. I don't have the answers. I'm just trying, man.
That's the best thing to admit, though. You know, like I don't know about anyone else, but my red flags go up whenever someone says that they do have the key. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, let's just have a good, intelligent conversation about our lack of keys. Like that to me is a more palpable conversation, you know, instead of going like, no, dude, like I figured it out and this is the gray alien agenda and this is what's happening here. And it's like, no, come on.
No.
Come on, let's be real. We don't know.
No.
We don't know. But there is a reality to it. There is a reality that you felt, that I felt, that so many people listening have felt. And I think as an experiencer, it's it speaks to you on a very fundamental level. I have no idea what it is that I experienced, but I know that what I experienced led to everything I'm doing now. And that to me is a good thing. You know, I feel good about that. Do you think that this control structure is inherently, I mean, you know, the word control would kind of suggest some form of malice or bad intention. So like, is there a positive element to this phenomenon in your opinion?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think it does, you know, kind of end the book on I purposely kind of got to the point where it wasn't all doom and gloom and I'm just going to hand you with, you know, all of this. It's basically, you know, we are more powerful than we know. We've been lied to. We've been manipulated throughout history. The community that we find with each other, the people who are experiencers, the conversations that you and I had for years, that John Luke have had, the people that you know have had these experiences and can talk to you without judgment or ridicule or, you know, making you feel a certain way or negatively, or even in society, is the basis of making the fundamental change that I think that should happen globally. And I think that we're doing that. We're creating that community through our conversations, through our podcasts, through our books, through whatever, and explaining in the way that we understand them that this is real. At least this is a real experience that people have. We don't know what it is. We share this experience and we also leave it open for other experiences and leave it open for other people's sharing and part of that community and creating that community to not be alone, to know. And I think that's what slowly starts the societal change. Like we talked about earlier, like people seeding society, like, you know, the billionaires, you know, or the mystery schools, we're going to see this in 1,000 years. It's going to, you know, we're going to, you know, it's going to be a thing. It's just a myth that we're making, but, you know, we're making our own myths right now, but they're not, they're happening to us, but we're putting it out there. We're not afraid. And I think that's whatever the phenomenon is kind of implying that's maybe what we should do. It wants to interact with us. We're interacting with it, but we should interact with each other too in a community to figure it out. We're not going to figure it out together. I mean, hell, we probably won't even figure it out all together, but at least if we're all reading from the same page and hold that space to not make people feel dumb or stupid or ridicule them, tinfoil hats, to hold that space for people to have these experiences and talk openly and about them without that fear. I think that's what those things in the sky are supposed to tell us, you know, in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of reminded of, in a way, what Terence McKenna would say about psychedelic experiences, in like the idea that this is something that can introduce an extremely novel idea into your mind. And also, it seems to be expanding consciousness. And if that is true, if it is expanding consciousness, or if it is in any way allowing more consciousness to enter into your perception, then we should be really focusing on that. That was his kind of thing. It's like, if it is doing that, then my God, like, we need as much of that as possible. Surely look at our world. So anything that seems to open the floodgate of an expansion of mind and consciousness should in some way be brought into society to help us evolve and grow. And I would say the same thing is very true, and I've said it a few times over the years, in terms of like a direct analog between UFO contact experiences and a psychedelic drug experience, because it's such a novel reality breaking experience for you. You can either accept it or reject it mentally in your own mind. But if you do accept it, your aperture increases, the size of your scope of reality increases. And I think with that comes an expansion of consciousness. Now, are we all perfect saints because we've had contact? Absolutely not. We're all human beings. We're all entrenched in the visceral and sticky and heavy experience of being a human being. Because my God, it's like, you know, it's a hard experience. But
anything that allows a little bit more of that mind to open up, I think, is a good thing. And that's what happened to me. That's what happened to you. And I know that people have had very different experiences with the spectrum of ufology. And I don't want to, you know, in any way say, oh, you know, it's all love and light and we should just be like, you know, fully open to everything. But I do think that there is an element to this, and it might not even be related to aliens. Again, we're throwing all of these things into the same kind of category, but it might not be explicitly the same thing. There is an element of this that I truly think is just about expanding your consciousness. And it's like a signal flare that pops up. Once you reach the right amount, you get a flash, you get an orb, you get a sign, you get a glint, you get a wink from the universe. Something is going, yeah, do that again. Keep doing that. And the more you do it, the more it happens. So I think that there is something maybe even baked into fundamental reality, which would be really encouraging to me if that's true, that this is a response from the universe itself in some way, you know?
I'm right on board with you, man. I think it is. I think it definitely is, because we've known, I mean, just from personal experiences, the more you pay attention to it, the more it happens. The more you put the intention in there, the more you get back from it, you know? And then that's amazing to see that we're on there. And I think that's where we're at. I think we're at the precipice, man. We're at the point where we have these conversations and we help other people that are new to them. I mean, there's people that are every single day, and it's so hard to be able to point them in a direction. Like, what do you do? I've had this crazy experience. I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, it's cool. And you just to hold the space for them, you know, to say, yeah, it's okay. You're not crazy, man. You're not crazy. You never were.
Yeah.
You know, you're not, this is a thing, right? And just strap in, right? But the other side of that is, like I talked about in my book, like I had those really scary experiences with ghosts, you know, what I perceive as ghosts or non-human entities at an early age and even into my teens. And then, like, I at one point just put it out. I'm like, no, this isn't real. I'm just making this up. It's something that's in for a long time. I mean, you could do that. You can flip that switch. You can be that skeptic and be like, none of this is real. It's overactive imagination. It's lights. It's, you know, whatever else. And you can turn that off. I mean, it's easy to turn that off just by not believing. It's just the other way. You know, you need to have something to kind of reawaken it in you, and then just, you know, try to hold that and not be so fearful and, you know, have the fear associated with it. But like you said, there's not all love and light, man. There's some negative experiences out there. There's people that, you know, live in a duality universe, right? You know, light and dark. I mean, there's both. So, you know, there's that too, but it's good to have the conversation and have people like you and, you know, to be able to talk to and when things get weird and because we can relate, right?
Yeah, no, likewise, brother, you know, you and Jean-Luc, and honestly, like, you two out of everyone else have been the most consistent in terms of friends and just fellow colleagues and researchers. We've you know, connected for a long time now, and our thoughts and our opinions have evolved on the UFO subject together as we've all kind of connected dots and realized things. So, you know, I'm really proud of you to be putting out this book. I would definitely encourage people to check it out, because John is such a great researcher. He's got a fantastic YouTube channel, UFOs on the Level. Links will be in the description box for obviously the YouTube channel, for the book. Do subscribe to him, drop a comment below, let us know what you think of this interview, and make sure you check out Contact and Control. John, it's been a pleasure as always, brother.
Thank you so much, man.